Thank you, choir. It is good to, any Sunday, come out to this place with a word in our hearts and to place a word in our ears. And so we come to the sermon time. I was remembering a minute ago one announcement that has to do with preaching that I ought to highlight and didn't a few minutes ago. That is that this afternoon, the annual business session of the Blackwater Baptist Association meets right here at our church. And that will begin at 3 and I believe begin in earnest at 3:30. But I believe as early as 3 we check in and fellowship and roll to a start. After the business is done, I will be preaching. So don't let that hold you back from coming. Come on anyway, because it'll be good to be here for the BBA meeting. But I will be preaching. Dinner will follow. And I believe we've had a pretty robust response to the dinner, to the point that it may be sold out. But we'd love to have you here this afternoon. And certainly the support and the critical mass of the home church is always a good part of a meeting like that. It'll be held in our chapel. So come on and be with us. This afternoon will be the fifth time that I have preached this weekend. It has been a weekend that I have absolutely loved and enjoyed, and I'm glad they're not all that way. I will have preached 4 sermons for a total of 5 times this weekend, and what an amazing, amazing set of events. The reason why I took a trip, those of you that are my Facebook friends saw that we were in Atlanta for a part of the weekend. I was invited by Day One Radio to come down and record 2 sermons. So that's 2 of the times I've preached, right into a microphone with a glass wall on the other side of it. Just about the time you forget that I've told you about that, those will air in late January. By way of your administrative counsel and the generous gifts of this church, our church is part of the underwriting of those 2 programs, and we'll tell you more about those as they get ready to air in January. But there are stations in Emporia, Chesapeake, and Norfolk that carry the Day One broadcast, and so we'll alert you to those. I'll be preaching those sermons here on those same Sundays in January, and what an honor to be a part of that tradition of Day One, or some of you may remember it as the old Protestant Hour that has aired on radio for generations. Well, today's scripture, you just heard Trina read to us that story that takes us back to one we visited earlier. Joseph is now with his brothers and their father has died. We pick that up in Genesis chapter 50, as you heard just a few minutes ago. And so we'll look at that. But first of all, you might be interested to know that since the year 1634, the small German village of Oberammergau has been basically known for one thing. Every 10 years, their production of the Passion Play draws what can only be described as a worldwide audience. It may be that some of you have traveled to Oberammergau on one of those every 10-year times and taken in that magnificent performance. Now, the town's population is well smaller than Franklin's, but people began planning their travel. They begin planning their travel years ahead to go there. And tour companies make big business of offering group trips built around a chance to see this play, this production. In fact, records indicate that the first group travel to go and see the Passion Play in Oberammergau began in the year 1870. Due to revisions, the play can last anywhere from 5 to 7 hours in a given offering of it. And there's always a dinner break built in because the play lasts so long. This is a total village effort, with theater seat groups assigned a specific village restaurant to go to so that the logistics of feeding that many extra people can be handled on any given day. And every time they put on the production, it will show for around 100 days. And when it is finished, the little village of Oberammergau will have hosted more than 500,000 people who have traveled there to see the play. The story of Christ's arrest, crucifixion, and resurrection is a big draw in Little Oberammergau. One friend of mine took his church group to see it a few decades ago. That year, they were doing a version of the play that lasted a full 7 hours. He sat in the insidemost seat of the block that his group had been assigned to. And so the lady to his left, a stranger from a different group, fell asleep right next to him about 3 hours into the play that day. Eventually, this stranger lay her head on my friend's shoulder as she watched the play and slumbered until the meal intermission finally arrived. And sure enough, she and part of her group were assigned to the table right next to my friend and part of his group. He saw the enthusiasm in her face, and he overheard as she exclaimed to her table that it was the most amazing and riveting thing she had ever witnessed. He still laughs telling about that to this day. But underneath it all, they say that the locals have a secret. One of the more sought-after roles for male actors is the part of Judas. That is, from an actor's standpoint, because at least it has a few lines, and certainly the betrayal of Christ casts that character in a pivotal spotlight. So this role is much in demand, as opposed to playing the part of the anonymous villager who wanders through with a donkey, for instance, right? Even if it is a villainous role. But locals whisper that the actor who will play Judas seems to pay a price. For as the 10-year hiatus comes to an end, and the rehearsals are going on in earnest, and it's almost time to revive the play, the actor who's been cast in that role begins to be ostracized locally. He may have a day job. He might wander into a local eatery. He is not treated the same as it comes time for the play to arrive, because it seems that the local villagers cannot separate the role that he plays from the person that they know him to be. And so this actor, time after time after time of them producing this play, the actors report that they are shunned to an extent by their friends and even their families. So intense is their knowledge of what that character will do to their Lord. You know, if any of us thought for long, we'd at least come up with a short list of villains in the Bible that we just can't let off the hook. We don't have a soft place for King Saul, for instance, because we know that he tried to kill our beloved King David. We might be tempted to growl at the mention of the pharaohs of Egypt because we know they wouldn't let the children of Israel go. And certainly Judas has his place, maybe atop the list of biblical villains as we think of them. Flawed characters. But Joseph's brothers are also on our list of villains. The whole group of them. Not a good one in the bunch, save little Benjamin maybe, who was also beloved by his dad and cast in a role very similar to the one that Joseph had been in. If we skip to the end of the story, we know that Joseph made his peace with them. And although he takes a few chapters to play with them, ultimately he is seen reconciling. And we're not sure how we feel about that. We would think that he has every right to hold on to a grudge and just chew on it for as long as he wants to. And that's where Joseph becomes an important teacher for us. A few weeks ago, we visited an earlier part of this story in Genesis. Joseph received his brothers into Egypt as they asked for rations during the famine, and eventually he revealed his identity to them and begged them to move there and be with him. He reconciled to them and, most importantly, was reunited with his aging father, Jacob. And I told you that in a few weeks we'd be coming back to that story, and that day has arrived. Now in Genesis chapter 50, something important has happened. the patriarch of the family, Jacob, son of Isaac, grandson of Abraham, has died. Trina read the story a few minutes ago, and you heard that he had spoken to his boys and instructed them in where and how he should be buried, and they have carried out those requests now, and they are back in Joseph's presence, and they are terrified. Not unlike some in our cultural mood of today, they have been raised in a tit-for-tat way of understanding. They were convinced that you get repaid for what you've done, good or bad. Grace was not even a familiar concept for them, much less of an option that they would have thought of now. Quite simply, now that their father was dead, they became nervous that they were in mortal danger. The second most powerful man in all of Egypt has taken control of their lives and has invited them in close to him. And they knew that they had done him so wrongly. As a relative child, you remember, they had thrown him down into a hole. They sold him into slavery, their own brother, and told their grief-stricken father that he had been killed by a wild animal. Their elaborate hoax even showed them shredding his infamous coat of many colors and streaking it with blood so that it would be a convincing piece of evidence in their story. And Jacob's heart was broken for all these decades at the loss of his beloved child. You remember the story. You ever do something that stuck with you? That act you committed, maybe even a season of unfortunate choices, or that thing you said that you couldn't take back. It could even be simply a bad moment of judgment, a decision made by you when otherwise you were a perfectly good person. And no matter how many years pass, it just won't go away. They knew what they had done. The cover-up continued. Now Joseph had reintroduced himself to them, but he had acknowledged their evil in granting his forgiveness. In their guilt, you see, as we arrive at Genesis 50, there was no way they could trust Joseph. Maybe he was simply waiting Jacob out. And now that their father wouldn't be around to see, they feared that he would exact his revenge. That's our backdrop today. I love the honesty that we see in this text, but I can't celebrate that until we acknowledge the deceit that also appears to be continuing. Liars lie, thieves steal, cheaters cheat. And sometimes the cliche turns out to be true. The tiger really can't change her stripes. There's another saying, and I think it's funny, but that has a little truth in it. Some people say just because you're not paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. Well, Joseph's brothers were noticeably paranoid. Much as we want the years to have changed them, and I think they did a little, and much as we want Joseph's gift of grace to have touched them, and I think it did a little, much as we want to give them a second chance, and I think we probably should a little, they go out and prove why they're on our biblical villains list. Here they go, hatching another deceitful plan. And it's at this moment I can't help but noticing something. The biblical notion that the sins of the fathers and mothers are often visited on the descendants. For these sons of the one who had deceived his blind and aging father out of his brother's birthright and had deceived that impulse-challenged hungry brother out of his inheritance for a bowl of pottage, that patriarch is the one who raised this whole clan of deceivers. Parents, at any age and any life stage, be careful what you show your children. You heard a few minutes ago that as our text unfolds, The brothers were hatching a scheme to try to save their own lives. They created a false deathbed statement from their father, a real tearjerker, in which Joseph is compelled to not exact revenge, but instead to take care of them. The fact that I kind of think he fell for it doesn't exactly warm my heart. Joseph wept openly in front of them again. Maybe he was touched by what he thought were his father's loving words. Or maybe he knew deep in his heart that there was a chance that this was another lie. We'll never know, probably. But here's where we could be challenged by Joseph, if we can put aside our loyalty to him and our disgust with them. Because whatever the case, Joseph declines to place them under punishing judgment. He sidesteps the clarity of supposing that he knows their heart. Am I in the place of God, he says. And today I would offer to you the same plea. I do not know how to explain to you or to justify to you all the movement of God within their story. That dimension of God will remain somewhat a mystery for me longer than I will live. Why does God do things in the way God does? And why are certain people allowed, it seems, to get away with the evil that they perpetuate? But again, their story and his story becomes our story, doesn't it? Speaking of stories, there's an old Buddhist story that you've probably heard. It's called Maybe. Todd Hobby tells it in his comments about this text. It seems there was an old farmer who had worked his crops for many years, and one day his horse ran away. And upon hearing the news, because horses were so important to their way of making a living, their way of sustaining themselves, his neighbors came to visit. Such bad luck, they said to the man sympathetically. Maybe, the farmer replied. The next day, the horse returned, and it brought three wild horses with it. And again the neighbors came back over. How wonderful, the neighbors exclaimed to the farmer. Maybe, he replied. The next day after that, the farmer's son tried to ride one of the untamed horses, and he was thrown and broke his leg. And the neighbors again came to offer their sympathy on his misfortune. Such bad luck, they said to the farmer. Maybe, he answered. The next day after that, The military officials came to the village to draft young men into the army. Seeing that the son's leg was broken, they passed over him and left him safely there with his family. And the neighbors congratulated the farmer on how well things had turned out. What good fortune, they exclaimed. Maybe, said the farmer. You know, we just can't know fully the good or the evil that may evolve from life's events. Paul nodded to this reality that I've mentioned to you from time to time already. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, he said, "Now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part, but one day I will know fully." Joseph says something honest here. Despite all we don't know and all we don't understand, Joseph says something honest here that could be profound for us. Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good in order to preserve a numerous people as he is doing today. So have no fear. I myself will provide for you and your little ones. And in this way, he reassured them, speaking kindly to them. In other words, Joseph makes a choice here that I hope I would make, but can't be sure I would. His vision, though, is what I take away with me from this text. He is able to see, to separate what they did out of their own free choice from what God eventually made of what they did despite the evil. Joseph is able to tap into the healing power of moving on. There is so much of life that eludes our control. There are people, relationships that frustrate because in the end we can only do our part and don't get to control what they bring to the table. There are real scoundrels and okay people too, whose bad choices can influence our lives for years to come. We may choose to move on with a person, with a situation, a commitment, a group, a family, despite the shortcomings we can't change, can't control, and won't likely do away with, because we love them, and because we can't imagine living without them, or don't want to live without them. We know what they are, but we move on with them, knowing the risks. Or we may choose to move on without a person, without a situation, a group, a family, because of the lack of inherent health and factors we have tried but simply couldn't change. Because someone's got to be healthy enough to do something different. Because to go on facilitating their ill choices, their bad behavior, will only encourage and enable them to keep on doing what they can't quit doing. We may move on with them, we may move on without them, but move on we must. It's the moving on that counts. You intended it for harm, but God intended it for good. You meant to hurt me, but God has done something new and different from that. I love the honesty of this text. We Christians are reminded of some of the basic concepts of grace and mercy. They form the very deepest bedrock foundation of our faith. They signal that God has indeed chosen to move on with us through Jesus Christ, despite who we may be and what may never be fully transformed about us. That's grace. That's mercy. Giving us better than we deserved out of an abiding sense of love. Sometimes we just have to make a choice that frees us to move on. Intentional evil, like the brothers perpetuated, may appear for a time to get the upper hand. But I have to believe in the providence of God. Joseph's choosing to move on teaches me here. I ought to stop and say something that's obvious, but that maybe we all need to hear me say. Wrong is wrong. Bad is bad. Each of us have suffered mistreatment at the hands of others. I could tell you a story or two from my life that still just seems to get me all riled up every time I think about it. You could tell similar stories. We all could. All of it, though, blends into the amalgam that has made me who I am. And as I stand here today, I wouldn't change a detail about how things have worked out. That doesn't make those wrongs right. Christians try sometimes, I think, to philosophize our way through pain, through wrong, through suffering, by using our faith to put up false fronts. Among the unintended consequences of that, for one thing, is we come off kind of fake or vanilla in the eyes of those around us who are watching us. They just don't buy the things we're saying sometimes out of our ought-to part of our faith. But even worse yet, we set ourselves up, I think, for personal and spiritual crisis when we end up having to eat our own cooking and life will not let it go down good. Or, if it helps you to hear it in its country version, as they used to say where I'm from, you can perfume that hog all you want to and it's still gonna stink. When we mistreat each other, no matter what God ends up doing with it, it's still wrong. Bad. Frederick Buechner is a favorite author of mine. And about the grace of God, he once said, "It's like this. here is the world. Beautiful and terrible things will happen. Don't be afraid. I am with you. It seems that people will sometimes do the most awful things. Sometimes they'll do those awful things to us. God gave them and us the freedom of choice. But that doesn't mean God isn't still at work. Even despite the bad that may happen, God is moving on. And I hope eventually we all choose to as well. So stick around with that confusing person, that group you can't quite get figured out, or shake the dust and leave them. One way or another, God is at work. And when we choose to clutch on to the healing power of moving on, when we can finally see clearly and healthfully enough to do something new, we give God a chance to unfold the next chapter of our lives. We have a hymn of response this morning. It's hymn number 341. You may be at a crossroad in your life that you want to talk about. You may be at a crossroad of having worshiped with us for a time and decided that you'd like to place your life in with the lives of the people in this church for membership. You may have decided that you'd like to accept Jesus and embark on your Christian relationship with God and Jesus as Savior. Or you may simply have a response that'll do right where you are as you sing the words of this hymn. I'll be down front, and we stand just now as we sing together hymn number 341, For the Beauty of the Earth.